This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.
UBS hires a former CEO to steer the Credit Suisse takeover. Plus, Lockheed Martin bets on the stars, and Beijing takes a new tact on tech.
Top officials have been quite busy sending messages to reassure private firms, both Chinese and multinationals, that China is open to business, it is supporting the private sector.
It's Wednesday, March 29th. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. UBS is bringing on a former CEO to head up the bank. The Swiss banking giant is tapping former leader Sergio Ermotti to return as CEO and replace current chief Ralph Hamers. Ermotti will have a lot on his plate after UBS agreed to take over longtime rival Credit Suisse earlier this month, a deal that will require it to integrate its operations and decide which divisions to downsize, on top of reassuring clients, employees, and investors. Ermotti, who previously ran UBS for 9 years, described that task as urgent and challenging. He'll take over on April 5th. Crypto exchange Binance is shedding deposits by the billions. According to crypto data provider Nansen, as of Monday evening, traders had pulled $2.1 billion from Binance's Ethereum blockchain over the preceding week. Nansen said that Binance still has more than $63 billion in publicly disclosed wallets. However, Journal reporter Julie Steinberg says those withdrawals come as Binance deals with a host of other issues.
This is happening after the Commodity Futures Trading Commission sued Binance on Monday, alleging it operated illegally in the U.S. and violated rules designed to prevent illicit financial activity. Investors and analysts are also monitoring for more regulatory action against Binance in the coming months, from the U.S. or perhaps elsewhere, so there's potentially more to watch there. And then internally, Binance has also been changing its fee structure, imposing fees on spot Bitcoin trading after cutting them to zero last summer. One crypto hedge fund manager told us that fees are extremely important and helps inform their decision on which exchange to trade on.
A Binance spokeswoman didn't immediately respond to a request for comment. We are reporting that Jamie Dimon will face questioning in a civil lawsuit over J.P. Morgan's relationship with alleged sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. The lawsuit is brought by the U.S. Virgin Islands, which says that J.P. Morgan facilitated the financier's sex trafficking by helping him to send money to his victims. J.P. Morgan cut ties with Epstein in 2013, but a judge earlier this month ordered the bank to turn over documents from Dimon through 2019. Dimon has so far resisted answering questions under oath, saying he played no role in the bank's relationship with Epstein. Epstein died in jail in 2019 while awaiting trial. Concerns are mounting that a decades-long era of nuclear arms control is beginning to unravel. The U.S. has told Russia that it will no longer share key data on its strategic nuclear forces, including the number of weapons deployed at specific U.S. bases. The move is a response to Russia's decision last month to suspend participation in a nuclear arms treaty known as START. The treaty limits the number of nuclear warheads and bombs deployed by the two countries and includes provisions for on-site inspections. Biden administration officials say the U.S. will continue to adhere to the treaty and that the move is meant to push Russia back into compliance. And Taiwan's leader, President Tsai Ing-wen, is stopping over in the U.S. today on her way to Central America. The trip could become a new point of contention between the U.S. and China, with Beijing warning of retaliation this morning if Tsai meets with House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. Journal Deputy China Bureau Chief Josh Chin.
They didn't specify what that retaliation would be, but when McCarthy's predecessor as House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited Taipei in August, The Chinese military responded with immense force. They conducted live fire military drills around the island in basically what amounted to a mock blockade. And they also cut off a lot of diplomatic channels with the U.S. And basically that whole incident sort of set off a downward spiral in U.S.-China relations. I mean, China is definitely watching this closely. The tightening ties between Washington and Taipei have been a consistent source of anxiety for Beijing. They don't want to see Taiwan drifting further into Washington's orbit. And Washington and Beijing have had a lot of trouble sort of getting the relationship back on track.
Lockheed Martin is launching a lunar infrastructure division. This month, the aerospace giant filed paperwork with the Federal Communications Commission in order to develop a satellite network for the moon, and that could be just the beginning. Wall Street Journal reporter Micah Maidenberg covers the business of space for us, and he's here now with the details of Lockheed's space ambitions. Micah, what is a lunar infrastructure division? It's a phrase I don't think I've said on the podcast before.
Lockheed Martin, through this new division, is thinking about how to serve missions that go to and close to the moon. There are a lot of missions sort of on the drawing board to send both satellites, rovers, landers, and of course humans, astronauts, back to the lunar surface in the coming years. And those missions are going to need various kinds of products and services and capabilities. But this new kind of unit at Lockheed is focused, at least initially, on communications and navigation services, almost like a GPS capability for folks and assets that are on the surface of the moon.
And Micah, how lucrative could this actually be for Lockheed? Because, I mean, without naming names here, there have been some recent forays into the business of space that have felt a bit more like vanity projects, shall we say.
Sure. I mean, there's no question that talking about a lunar infrastructure market, you're talking about something that doesn't exist today and hasn't existed in the past. What Lockheed and other companies are doing is looking at, you know, the renewed ambitions coupled with real spending from government agencies and some private space entities as well, and saying, look, these folks are setting ambitions to get back to the moon one way or the other, and they're going to need help doing that. And here, this new division is the company's attempt to sort of get in front of that and start building a business around serving those missions going forward.
Finally, Micah, what's the competition like here? Lockheed obviously will attract attention when it makes an announcement like this, but are they the only ones sort of trying to capitalize on some of the new industry opportunities stemming from space exploration?
They're not at all. There is a broader push across a number of companies, big and small, that focus on space to figure out how to deliver services and products and build a business around the future lunar economy, if you will. For example, there's a company called Quantum Space that's led by a former top official at NASA that's working on sort of a fleet of space vehicles that would help provide similar services, navigation, communication, space weather forecasting for ships traveling between Earth and the moon. There are rover startups and, you know, other companies that are sort of thinking about the moon as literally a place to do business.
That was Wall Street Journal reporter Micah Maidenberg, who covers the business of space for us. Micah, thank you so much. I have a feeling we're going to be speaking a lot more in the next few years.
Thank you, Luke. Take care.
Coming up, the word from Beijing is that China is reopened for business. But can China actually win back the confidence of its homegrown entrepreneurs as well as skittish multinationals? We've got that story after the break.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. Insights. You need them to solve business problems, but buried in volumes of disparate data, they're seemingly invisible. C3 Generative AI enables business leaders to instantly access secure, hallucination-free, verifiable insights from a unified knowledge source, all with a natural language search. Turn the invisible into the obvious with C3 Generative AI. Learn more at c3.ai.
Chinese tech giant Alibaba is being split into six independent companies. That news effectively dismantles a business empire and comes after Chinese authorities spent years trying to rein in the country's powerful tech sector. But could this actually be a sign that China is easing its crackdown on the domestic tech industry and restoring the confidence of Western firms in doing business in the country? Wall Street Journal Deputy China Bureau Chief Yoko Kubota joins me now from Beijing to try and put all of these headlines together. Yoko, let's start locally with the news about Alibaba co-founder Jack Ma reappearing in China this week, and then the announcement shortly thereafter that Alibaba is going to be splitting into these six independent companies. What do these events signal, and could they possibly be related?
Alibaba's announcement came at a very interesting time, and it kind of feels symbolic for someone that's been following the company for a while. So Alibaba is one of China's biggest tech companies. It's an e-commerce empire that was co-founded by and built by Jack Ma. And it's a big part of people's daily lives here. It's powerful in the sense that it has a lot of information and data about the people that are buying stuff and using its service, as well as the information that Alibaba and its platforms can get those people to see. Jack Ma built his business empire over two decades or so. And around the time that he reappears in China after not being on the mainland for about a year, as far as we know, Alibaba announced that now that empire that Jack built is going to be split into six. That six includes key businesses like China e-commerce, global e-commerce, logistics, cloud computing, etc. And it seems like those business groups are going to be quite independent in the sense that they're going to be allowed to raise external capital themselves and seek IPO when they're ready.
So what's the meaning of that?
Right. So it also comes at a time when China has been showing signs that regulatory clampdown has been easing. It's interesting because China has also mentioned many times during the clampdown that they are concerned about the disorderly expansion of capital. So in that sense, all of these time together is quite symbolic. Although people inside the company has told the Wall Street Journal that the announcement wasn't necessarily related to Jack Ma's return.
Yoko, are we seeing other signs, maybe besides Jack Ma's return to China, that Beijing really is trying to impress upon domestic entrepreneurs that they have room to grow and should be confident? After all, China's golden child of entrepreneurship, TikTok, could conceivably still be banned in the U.S. So there are clouds still circling here, right?
Right. So Jack Ma's return is the latest development in China where, you know, this year top officials have been quite busy sending messages both internally and externally to reassure private firms, both Chinese and multinationals, that China is open to business, it is supporting to private sector. And this all comes at a time when China's economy has been quite sluggish following 3 years of COVID controls, as well as the regulatory clampdown that's been also ongoing for 2 years. For instance, you know, China's new premier, Li Qiang, when he did his first news conference this month, he devoted a large section of his news conference to reassuring entrepreneurs of Beijing's support for the private sector. He also said that the government's commitment in this regard is unequivocal and steadfast. At a recent conference that took place in Beijing, where multinational executives and officials from China both attended, officials there were also repeating that kind of message that China is open to business and supporting the private sector.
And so in terms of whether that message, Yoko, is finding a receptive audience among foreign executives in particular, we saw Apple CEO Tim Cook, for instance, back in Beijing last weekend saying he was thrilled to be back. And he was just one of dozens of American and other foreign executives to be in Beijing. And yet, has Beijing done enough to truly restore the confidence of foreign businesses that China is a good, sound place to do business?
That's a good question. I think that the executives certainly welcome this kind of message, that China's doors are wider and wider and that they are welcome to do business here. But these kinds of reassurances also come at a time when there are worrying signs for multinationals. Most recently, we have seen detention or disappearance of employees at certain American and Japanese companies. They include Mintz and Astellas Pharma. We also had a case of Deloitte, where Deloitte's Beijing office, its operation was suspended for 3 months, and it was fined an unprecedented $31 million over alleged lapses in its auditing work of a state-owned company. The reassuring message on its own from government officials may not quite be enough at this stage for multinationals to feel confident to keep expanding and renew investment in China.
That was Wall Street Journal Deputy China Bureau Chief Yoko Kubota joining us from Beijing. Yoko, thank you so much for the update.
Thank you very much.
And finally, could increased pay transparency make employees work harder? Several studies into the links between pay transparency and worker productivity and motivation suggest the answer is yes. And while many employers have historically been wary of pay transparency, amid concerns it could cause tension at the office, WSJ contributor Courtney Vinopal says the context in which salary information is shared is key.
If employers just share the salary ranges for certain jobs, that doesn't necessarily tell workers much. But if they share the expected salary ranges for a role and what competencies you need to develop to reach that salary level, then workers understand what they need to do and it can actually be motivating. And then I think one interesting exception to the overall findings is that at the group level, in departments or institutions where there are high disparities in pay, that actually causes a drop in productivity overall. So whether academics are making more or less than their peers, they realize they're working in an environment that isn't fair, and that can be very demotivating.
And that's What's News for Wednesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
This message comes from Wall Street Journal sponsor C3 AI. C3 Generative AI equips enterprises with verified, traceable answers. It's secure, hallucination-free, LLM agnostic, and IP liability-free. Learn more at c3.ai. This is Enterprise AI.